Ladies and gentlemen, we are on Daf Gimel Amud Bet. Daf Gimel Amud Bet, 3B1. We have this class this week, and next week we also have a Hanukkah party in the latter part of our class, which is our tradition. We'll light the Hanukkah, and we'll have a party during the time of the class. I'll see if maybe by then I'll have a few pictures to show my trip from last week. It was a very interesting trip. Maybe I'll talk about it on Shabbat, I don't know. We'll see. We were in Japan last week. So it was very much.
Interesting, huh?
Very interesting. Touring. Yeah, vacation.
Did you find your friend?
No. I didn't have time. I was just there for such a short time. Next year.
How long were you there?
I was there probably traveling about 6 days. So it was a day traveling, and a day traveling each way. Although I had those of you who were in the Minyan Monday tell the story that I had a unique experience. Never had an experience like this before. First time in my life, on just a Jewish type of experience. Sunday, I spent a whole day getting. Come sit over here. You're far away. I spent all from the morning getting to the plane. When I got to a plane in Tokyo, plane left Tokyo at 6:30 in the evening. It was a rush. There was a lot of pressure because I was in one side of Japan. I had to get to the other side of Japan in order to be able to make this plane back. It works well in Japan. You can set your watches by the trains. The train is never more than a tenth of a second late. So it's not a problem. So every time you're going somewhere, you can't be more than a tenth of a second late either. So you adapt to that. So I don't know time, and I tried to daven, and so I never got to daven mincha. Got on the plane. It was night. I daven maariv. Sat down, calmed down. Daven maariv. Now Jewishly Monday night. Sunday night is Monday. Never done it. And then I got over the States. However many hours later, I don't know. I got a minute. For Sunday. Do you realize that? I got a Monday's Mars first and then Sunday's minute. Unique experience. I never had that experience before. I went backwards. I actually went backwards in the davening. So that was, just one aspect of how utterly unique such an experience could be.
Had you davened in Minoka in Japan, you wouldn't have
done it. I wouldn't have done it, that, correct. But I didn't. I was so rushed that I never got a chance to get around to it. And so I'm sitting there, I look out the window, light out there. It's like the day before.
You could tell it was already in the afternoon.
Correct. Look, I had gone back.
Wouldn't you have had a shocker between them?
No, that's the amazing thing. I mean, never had a shocker. No?
Next day you had the shocker.
Correct. I'm not sure.
How do you think about that?
Well, last Friday, at the I gave a Vartara in the Minyan last Friday about the halachic ramifications of crossing the date line. Were any of you there last Friday? No, nobody was there. The Friday was in the morning. Last Friday morning, I talked about the issues of crossing the international date line. It's absolutely fascinating because if you think about it, and the history, I'll just give you a nutshell of the whole thing. If you, first of all, according to the halakha, there's no reason to assume that our halakha accepts the international dateline the way it is. You have to have an international dateline of some kind. Logic would force that. But logic doesn't force the international dateline as it exists. It could be a lot of different places. You know, that's convention. That's convention. So in the history of halakha, the beginning of the 20th century, you have a lot of discussion of this because it became an issue. Jews are traveling, and there are a variety of theories. And among them, one of the major theories was the international dateline should be 90 degrees east of Jerusalem. 90 degrees east of Jerusalem. Because that way, Jerusalem's the center of the world. You've got 90 degrees one way, you've got 90 degrees the other way, and basically you function from Jerusalem. Right. So, and sometimes a lot of times work that way. Greenwich Mean Time, what does Greenwich mean?
Excuse me, I sit on the meridian of Greenwich on Friday.
Could you? Well, that's great. Good for you. That's great. Great.
So what's wrong with that? We had a rabbi who was accused of traveling, and those days they came to Dr. Naraska to travel on Shabbos by airplane because he left Tokyo Shabbos evening, not the Shabbos.
Very interesting. Strange things can happen. So let me finish what I'm saying. So if the dateline were 90 degrees east of Jerusalem, Japan would be in the American zone. Okay, it would be the same day as in the United States. So if you were traveling from Japan, from New York to Japan, let's say, on a Thursday, okay, you would get to Japan on a Friday. And then the next day would be Shabbat. Whereas if the Japanese, the Jewish community there, was observing, and of course the Japanese themselves, they don't know about Jerusalem time. They go by the international dateline. So it would be Saturday, it would be your Shabbat, and it would be their Sunday. You see what can happen? So the question is, even the Jewish community would have to observe, if the community were there, would have to observe the same day as the people. So you could have one Jew coming from New York having a different Shabbat than the Jews who are living there. All of that is a consequence of setting the international dateline 90 degrees east of Jerusalem. So there are a lot of interesting complications come as a result of this. So the halakha is that you have to go in issues that pertain to your day. You go according to where you are. In issues that pertain to anything beyond the day, you have to go according to where the place is. Okay? So that, for example, it's become the crucial issue in the counting of the sphera. When you count the sphera from the second day of Pesach, right, you count the sphera, what happens when you cross the dateline?
You lose a day.
Maybe yes, maybe no. I mean, you have to just make that decision. You have to decide what it is. Or if you're going then, if you're doing the traveling, what davening do you do? Do you do the davening of your day or of the next day? Because it becomes the next day at a certain point. If, for example, it's the night, if it's the night when you cross the day line, do you daven Marv twice? Or you daven Marv once? Okay? So the halakha is, the generally accepted halakha is that you do it once because it pertains to you alone. What pertains to you alone, you go according to your time. Okay? But what pertains to something beyond you, then you don't go according to your time, you go according to the other time, particularly when it has ramifications for the week, the month, or the year. You go not according to your experience, but according to the experience of the people where you're going. So these are the kinds of things that you have to think about.
So you haven't even done with the Jewish astronaut.
Huh?
Good. The same mission. And Joseph and I will have the same grandma.
The other one is being above the Arctic Circle.
Right.
Where the sun doesn't go down at all.
Correct.
And we were close to the Arctic Circle when you shoot off in Sweden, and you met a whole different group of people coming out of Shul, each of whom had a different interpretation of what to do. In some sense, you go by Jerusalem nighttime. But the most creative one was an Israeli who said, "A Jew doesn't belong above the Ark of Truth."
What do you do?
There are basically two ways to do it. Both are, Barry just said two. There's yet a third, and that is that you take the line of longitude, and you go according to the line of longitude to the nearest Jewish community, and you follow their time. Yeah. So let's say in Stockholm, or even if the problem in Stockholm, because you can have such, you can have life forever. Right. So you can go south. You basically, what you do, you go south according to the line of longitude, and when you hit the Jewish community there, you follow their time. So, I think the best answer is the one the Israeli gave you. Another time. Okay. Now we are on 3B1. And we come to a subject which, in fact, we've already seen. So, one of the things that this is kind of a subject, and the way in which the subject will be dealt with, is frankly rather bizarre. And it's bizarre in terms of its content, but you will see after we get into it, and that's why it's important for us to cover a certain amount of ground with this, you will see that in fact we are dealing with a certain, almost a composed unit of thought. What we are going to begin now on 3B1 is really the beginning of a sugya, which goes through the three ways to make kiddushin: kesef, shtar, and bia, through money, through a document, and through intercourse. And you will see with each of them establishes the logic or the scriptural source for the particular method of making kiddushin. Now, I say that this is a little bit repetitive because, in fact, on the first amud, the very first page that we studied, we already saw that. The very first thing that we saw was kesef. Remember, it was kicha, kicha. It says, ki kach ish isha, when a man takes a woman for a wife, and then the story of Abraham and the field of Ephraim the Hittite, where, in fact, Abraham gave money, and he acquired the field, and the word is lakachat. The same Hebrew verb is used, and so we know that money and lakachat is together, and therefore when it says ki kach ish isha, we know that money is a form of acquisition. Okay?
So creation.
Well, that I did. That we showed you there. But the Talmud didn't do that. Okay? I did that. The Talmud didn't do that. The Talmud already told us that, but now we're going to see that, at least as far as the Talmud is concerned, that's not necessarily so obvious. And you may wonder why we're sort of repeating the subject. The Rashi says, and you'll find it here in English, let's see where it is, I think number 8 maybe. Oh, look at number 7. Look at number 7 on 3B1. Although the Gemara had previously noted a source of kiddushin through money, it had done so only in a peripheral manner, simply to justify the Mishnah's use of the term acquire. The Gemara's central discussion of the topic takes place here. Well, that may be true, or may not be true. My own sense is that something else is going on here. That really, in the editing of the Gemara, keep in mind that the Gemara is a book that is edited, and that there are a variety of traditions that are edited together. And I'm not sure always that the editing is so logical as it is sometimes because there is an already formulated piece of discussion that is a total discussion. In fact, that will come sometimes just as an entirely formulated discussion. And it may be that we've already dealt with one piece or another piece of that in a different context. But because something exists as a totality, it will continue to exist as a totality. Now keep that in mind. It's a little abstract what I'm saying to you now, but keep it in mind as we go through this, because some of this will seem so obtuse that I think until we get through all of it and you see that in fact there's a structure to it, and what we are going to do is to plod through a certain type of logical development of an idea, and in fact it will apply to each of the forms of kiddushim, and each one will be developed in exactly the same way. Okay? And then you'll see that it holds together. Till we get there, maybe some rough water. Okay? So, the Gemara then begins with stating, Dechasef Minalam. How do we know, from where do we know that you can make kiddushin with money? Right? As if we don't know that already. We already know it. But this discussion doesn't know that we know it. Okay? But it's just taking off on its own. The two habits, none, and furthermore, that which we have learned in a Mishnah, here read the English, concerning a girl who has not yet reached full legal independence. Okay? Let me see if there's a Bible behind you. Is there a Bible down there? The Tanakh, that's the right one. Thank you very much. The Mishnah elsewhere discusses the subject of a girl. Now, I'm going to read to you the biblical portion. It's odd stuff, but it's in the Bible. And in case you think the Bible doesn't have any odd stuff, you should know better. One of the problems of reading the Bible is that sometimes you can see what it says, and it doesn't always say what you want it to say. So you'll see some of the interesting and strange things in chapter 21 of the book of Exodus. This is the beginning of Parashat Mishpatim, which contains a major section which is perpetually embarrassing to Jews for a variety of reasons. First of all, the most obvious one, because it's the one that jumps out at us, but it's not necessarily the most embarrassing, is slavery. There are basic laws of slaves there. Here I read to you in the beginning of 21. These are the rules you shall set before them. When you acquire a Hebrew slave, he shall serve 6 years. So to begin with, obviously there is some sort of concept of a Hebrew slave. Now that's what you want to see in the Bible. Basically, you don't want the Bible to say that, but so it's obviously a problem. Now, chapter 21 of Mishpatim, keep in mind, the reality is that this context is just after the giving of the Torah, which is itself 7 weeks after the Exodus from Egypt. Okay? Just 7 weeks, it's Shavuot, the 50th day. So that it's really not at all strange to discuss the subject of slaves. And of course, the way to understand it would be to see what kind of slave this is as opposed to the other kind of a slave. Namely, is this like the other kind of a slave? And of course, it's not. The way modern scholarship will deal with this is that it will put the two of them together. And we will see what, in fact, slavery was and what slavery is here. So this is a far more reasonable system. It's a much better system. This is, in fact, a system that's closest to our notion of what we had in this country of indentured servant. This is when a person is down on their luck. They run out of money. They need money for one reason or another. There's a variety of ways to get it. One way is to sell your services. The form of the selling of services is not exactly a free sale of services. In fact, the court can sell your services, and you become the indentured, the Hebrew slave, the Eved Ivri. Now, we tend not even in my preaching, I rarely ever, I won't say that. I'll say the Hebrew servant. I don't say the Hebrew slave. Mm-hmm. It's too embarrassing. I don't like to say it requires too much explanation. You know, comparison, it's not really a phrase. It doesn't sound good in English. But that's how it begins. And I'll be bold enough to tell you what it actually says. When you acquire a Hebrew slave, he shall serve 6 years. In the seventh year, you should go free without payment. Okay, so it's for a limited period of time. Now, that's interesting, that you can't have this situation go on indefinitely. Clearly is an indentured servant-type relationship. It automatically terminates after a period of 6 years. The seventh year, he goes free without payment. In other words, you don't have to buy your freedom back. If he became single, he shall leave single. If he had a wife, his wife shall leave with him. If his master gave him a wife and she has borne him children, the wife and her child shall belong to the master, and he shall leave alone. Okay, so the guy could have been used, in fact, as a stud in the meantime to produce more slaves for somebody else. So in a way, now, this is not just a plain indentured servant. It may also be desirable for a variety of reasons for the guy to be able to do stuff like this. First of all, there's a sex life. Mm-hmm. Yeah, for whatever, however you want to rate that. What?
I think you guys always come out ahead.
Well, I could think of worse things. So that happens. It's to the benefit of the master, too. And obviously there is a sense here that there is the possibility of producing some sort of children. But if the slave declares, I love my master, my wife, and children, I do not wish to go free, that could also happen. His master shall take him before God. He shall be brought to the door or the doorpost, and his master shall pierce his ear with an awl, and he shall then remain a slave for life. Okay? In a way, I think this whole thing is to get to that verse in order to make it clear that you shouldn't do such things. In fact, you have to put a hole in the guy's ear. And what the rabbis say, which is what I think is implicit in this, that the ear that heard on Sinai that there is a God and that you are his people, and I am the Lord your God who took you out of Egypt. Right? That's the first commandment. That ear should maintain the mark of its own humility because of its embarrassment and its debasedness when a person decides of his own free will to continue this type of servitude. Okay? It's not a desirable thing. Now, if that weren't bad enough, that's the easy stuff. This is really where it gets more interesting. When a man sells his daughter as a slave, she shall not be freed as male slaves are. If she proves to be displeasing to her master who designated her for himself, he must let her be redeemed. He shall not have the right to sell her to outsiders since he broke faith with her. And if he designated her for his son, he shall deal with her as is the practice of free maidens. If he marries another, he must not withhold from this one her food, her clothing, or her conjugal rights. If he fails her in these three ways, she shall go free without payment. I'm going to go back and read this more closely. Obviously, there is some sort of system here. Ki in court ish ebito. A man can, in fact, put his daughter, a man has is in a position to be able to put his daughter into this condition of servitude. Not only that, when it says she shall not be freed if male slaves are, in fact, that's not a negative, it's a positive. In other words, the male slave has to wait to the seventh year. The daughter has a variety of ways to get out of that earlier. That's the ramification of that verse here. If she proves to be displeasing to her master, who designated her for himself. In other words, this system is one of, in fact, marrying off the daughter to the guy. Right? You can take the daughter and marry her off to this guy, and that's the desired end result, apparently, of this system. He must let her be redeemed. If she proves to be displeasing to her master, who designated her for himself, let's say the guy who is the master doesn't like her. So then he must let her be redeemed. She can get out then on the payment of a particular amount of money. Right? You pay. Well, the father has to pay, because in fact she has no, she's a, generally speaking in the law, children have very few rights. And in fact, you can see the daughter has very compromised rights. Yeah, the father has the right to do this, and the father has to pay, and he has an obligation too, to pay to get her out of this situation. He shall not have the right to sell her to outsiders. It could be that the father, outsiders means probably Gentiles. Right? The father could say, well, my daughter is a piece of chattel. I'll make money. I'll sell her, right? She's a desirable quantity. This guy doesn't want her, I'll give it to somebody else. Can't do that. Since he broke faith with her, that is to say, since the designated master, since they went into this arrangement assuming that that was where it was going to go, since the man decided not to go through with it, she's got to be protected at this point. Not that it was such a good situation, he put her into the first place. But at this point, she's got to be protected, and you can't just sell her after that. And if he designated her for his son, right, this master could have designated, said, no, I'm not going to marry her, but my son will. He shall deal with her as is the practice with free maidens. Here, now, you get to the protections of the law, that if she is married then in this circumstance, then she is married the same as any other woman who is married. Which is to say, because she went into this as a slave, then she was paid to begin with, as the father was paid. Once the marriage takes place, then she is the same as any other wife. Namely, all the protections of the law that would be for a woman fall upon this woman as well, lest you had thought that because she entered into it in this unseemly fashion, you know, from our perspective, that she had fewer protections. Now, if he marries another, here are the protections. He must not withhold from this one her food, her clothing, and her conjugal rights. This is the Torah source of the husband's obligations toward the wife. Any husband's obligation toward his wife. Namely, a husband is obliged to provide food. Shirak suta ve'onata. A husband is required to provide food, clothing, and conjugal relations. It's a very interesting law that in Jewish law, a man has the obligation to have sex with his wife. It's really kind of a startling thing, because one would have assumed that you know, that before 1955, no woman had ever thought of that. it was a totally modern thing.
Yeah.
But obviously somebody thought of it a little bit before. This is in the Torah, that the woman has the right to these relations. And in fact, in the Talmud Masechet Ketubot, there's a whole piece, most of one chapter, which deals with the question of what does that mean? How often? How often does a man have to have relations with his wife? And that's based on two considerations, which are the outgrowth of the kind of work that he does. One is geography, where the work brings him, and two is physical fatigue. That there are certain types of jobs, and the Talmud talks about if a man is a donkey driver. donkey drivers. Sydney?
Yeah. I think truck drivers, they go on long
hauls. Truck drivers. Donkey drivers.
Donkey drivers.
And sailors. Talmud talks about sailors. Sailors once every 6 months. Okay, Talmud Chacham very frequently because he's local. And it, and he sits around studying all day. He doesn't use any energy. Okay? So his wife has the right to make a great number of demands from him. So, and the real force of this is not so much the it's hard to I actually had a case of somebody who came to me once and wanted to sue her husband for divorce because he wasn't having relations with her. She wanted me to force him to have relations with her.
Oh, no.
Yeah.
So, what did you do?
I said, what do you want me to do? I said, if you can figure out how I can do that, I'd be happy to oblige.
Why did the car come to you?
Because she was aware of the law. She was aware it's a matter of Jewish law. Rabbis are supposed to be able to enforce the law. So I'm just saying to you, the point is that it's a hard law to enforce at this level. The real force of this thing is that it gives the wife a veto power over a husband's change of job. That's the real issue. Real issue here. Because what it means is, let's say he works in New York, and he says, I have a chance for tremendous advancement if I go to California. In a Jewish court, she has a right to divorce him. I should say, well, he could say, I'll go there for 2 weeks at a time, now I'll come back and forth. Right? I was living here, I'll go to every 2 weeks, I'll come back and forth. She can say yes if she wants it. But if she says no, she has a good case against him to divorce him in a Jewish court. Because he's changing the facts of the case, which in fact will change the nature, the number of times he will have relations with her. And since she has the right by the Torah gives her that right, the court will accept her demand over his demand.
I would think that the right for the relations from the point of view of the woman is that she cannot be put in a position where she is not permitted to reproduce.
Nope, not it. It's much more modern than that. It's a very simple situation. I mean, I would say that that's not unlikely, that there's maybe an issue. But the conception of is simply pleasure. And pleasure is a basic issue in Malacha. If you want to read a very, very interesting book on this, Rabbi David Feldman's book on birth control and Jewish law, published by NYU Press, where Feldman shows the whole history of this idea coming out of this verse, which is that sex has two functions in Judaism. One is reproductive and the other is pleasure. And it is the balance between reproduction and pleasure which in fact is the source of the law that develops over the years, as opposed to the notion that it is for reproduction and that pleasure is either secondary or not at all important. That's how that pleasure is a means to drive people to reproduction, but that in fact the law is governed or should be governed by reproduction. That's not Jewish law. Jewish law recognizes both pleasure and reproduction as two valid issues of the sexual response in men and women.
I thought part of the reason might be it's a polygamous society, and also the Torah says if you take a second wife, of course she's going to be younger and prettier than the first one.
Okay, so
you shouldn't take you off.
Well, that is, of course, there's no doubt in the context here that both of your points are well taken, but slightly different. I just amended in the following way. It says, if he marries another, that assumes a polygamous society, okay? So it is polygamy. So it's not, he must marry another, but if he marries another, and of course this is the problem of the woman who came in through this back door, as it were. She came in as the child slave. Right? That's not a very good way to come in. So you might say that that's humbling, and that in fact he wants to get a wife that he really wants. You know, not the one that he entered into in order to get somebody to clean his, to polish his boots. Basically, ended up being his wife. But he wants to make a free and independent choice. So even so, the nature of marriage is that he cannot withhold his rights from her, that in fact she has the right to demand them, and he must give them to her. Okay? Which, of course, and in part of the ramification of that is that he'll think twice before marrying another wife. That's why you have so few instances of polygamy, and certainly in the Talmud you don't have them, because it is simply too difficult to do. Number one, it's too expensive. The Talmud is very aware of the emotional issues as well. And thirdly, it's sexually demanding. It's not really the one yet.
Part of the thing that is particularly disturbing about this is that the word wife is not used in regard to this servant at all.
Mm-hmm.
It's used in regard to the second one. But I didn't hear, I mean, maybe I missed it, but I didn't hear her ever referred to as a wife. So mm-hmm. It's almost sounds as though it's a slave who then is sexually taken advantage of.
Mm-hmm. Maybe, but first of all, it's not. He can't have sex with her. His girl, he cannot have sex with her. Unless he wants to marry her. Okay? Yeah. Is it clear? That's a good question. Excuse me? Oh, that's a good point. That's a good point. Since we know that there are three types of kiddushin, in fact, he could acquire her that way as one of the three ways, but the issue is that he then becomes responsible to her as a wife, as a husband to a wife, which is really a downer if you want to just have sex. I mean, a lot of people will tell you this story. The story, you can read it again and again. The thing that men don't want is commitment. Commitment. Sex is not bad, but commitment, that's something else entirely. What?
Clothing and feeding
that goes with it. Correct, exactly. It's the clothing and the feeding. The clothing and the feeding is one big can in the neck. So that's what's not desirable. Yes, the language, it doesn't say wife per se, but I think that, I don't think that the rabbis are turning this one inside out. I think that this is implicit on what is being said.
If he has sex, he must marry her anyhow. That's what the lady says. By definition, it's...
No, not necessarily by definition.
If you ever should find your sex with her, unless you need cars up for her.
Yeah, the question is whether there is a possibility of a concubine-type relationship here. And that's a question. I can tell you that as far as the rabbis go, they read that out of this. They don't want to see that. In fact, what they want to see is that you have to make a decision.
Right.
If you want to have sex with her, you got to have a wife. Right? And that's what they want to, that's surely what they want to read out of this.
And everybody
will say. That's correct.
If a man and woman have unmarried men and women have consensual sex without the intention of it being marriage, of having the commitment of marriage, is it still considered marriage?
No, not marriage at all. It's called sex. Correct. But keep in mind that my answer and your analysis presupposes rabbinic literature. We presuppose what we've already learned. We know the laws as they are. When we're going to be reading the Talmudic text now, one of the things that you think about when you read this Talmudic text is how much of this is in fact the law of the Torah? Or are we reading rabbinic law here? Now, is this a creation, an institution that is the product of the rabbis. And you will see that that's not a small issue here. Because the way this whole thing is going to be developed is really based on whether this law comes from Scripture or not. If you derive it on the basis of logic, well, then it's one kind of law. If it's in Scripture, it's another kind of law. And then even then, it's not so clear, because is it the kind of Scripture that you're just citing for the sake of citing Scripture, or is it really in Scripture? And those are the kinds of questions you want to ask in the history of Jewish law. And this particular issue, it's not so clear. Okay?
To go back to the rabbinic court, doesn't the man have the final say by saying no to a guest?
In that instance, if the woman presents
her case. What are you bringing up the guest? Is she allowed to get a divorce at that time before the guest?
Well, if we're talking about this, what we're reading from Exodus,
yeah.
In fact, there was no need for a guest because she was not married. All right? If she is in this situation of the girl, let's call her the girl slave.
Okay.
If she's in that situation, she's not married to the guy. If the guy could marry her, because obviously this institution presupposes some intent, or at least the possibility of that intent, and may presuppose even more than that. I don't know. I don't really know. But if that were not to come to pass, then, in fact, the father has to pay for her redemption. She's got to get out of there. She's got to get out of there, because that's not a situation that apparently the Torah is going to tolerate.
He told her, because he's in such dire straits, how can I redeem?
That's a good question. Because part of what is happening here is that he is... I can imagine where he said he could redeem her. Huh? He's got another daughter.
You
can go from bad to worse, huh?
He doesn't have the money, he already told him what.
Well, it could be that he does have the money over time, you know. We're talking about a six-year period of time, and within that period of time, it could be that his circumstances turn for the better. In the other case, the male slave is sold for 6 years. Okay, that's a full course of slavery. This woman, if she ends up not being married, then she gets out of it. But you could take a loan. I mean, a variety of ways you could do it.
But it would not if it's not 6 years.
No, it would not if it. The point is of the Torah that it's not 6 years. That it can end at any point, and that the key thing that will make it end is a payment. Right. A payment changes status. That is going to be the key issue, and you'll see that is why all of this is brought up. I had to give you all this background because it just seems so bizarre to the modern reader. And the fact that I bring you the background doesn't necessarily make it any less bizarre. But the reason why this is all brought up is that finally we have in fact come to see a situation where the payment of money does create a change of status in a young woman. Okay? In a young woman. Now, one more piece of background. In fact, there are three kinds of women. Three kinds of women depending upon their ages. There is a ketana. Let's just say a ketana. Then there is a na'ara, and then there is a bogeret. A katana is a minor. And one of the things that's interesting about this is that this is also the source, this kind of discussion is the source of an idea of when a woman, she is majority, when a woman becomes a person according to the law. You know, a boy becomes a person at 13, bar mitzvah. Bar mitzvah is when?
12.
Correct. So a girl, a ketana, a minor, is somebody beneath the age of 12. A na'ara is somebody from the age of 12 for the next 6 months. Six months. She's called a na'ara. after that point, she is called a Bogeret. When she is a Bogeret, in fact, she has the right to make certain decisions without her father's consent. And the father does not have the right to force her into any situation. Okay? At least these major ones. Okay? So you have to keep all of that in mind. And in this case, the Torah says, let's see if it says anything. We do see from the context that it is the father who sells the daughter. So this could not be a Bulgarian to begin with. Could not possibly be a Bulgarian. It could either be one or two of the other younger situations. Right? One or two. And then, in fact, when there is a payment here, and if he doesn't agree, he shall deal with it. If he marries and he must not withhold from her. If he fails her in these three ways, she shall go free without payment. Oh, so in other words, if he's not willing to really take seriously his marriage, she goes free and without payment, which would mean that she would get divorced. But in other words, the father doesn't have to make any payment to the guy. If he marries her and doesn't fulfill his obligations as a husband.
What was the word I thought before you said that if she doesn't please him, then the father has to redeem her?
That was slightly different. No, that was...
When she took her as a slave girl.
If he proves to be displeasing to our master who designated her for himself, he must let her be redeemed.
Right. Okay. Is that, irrespective of what it will ever discuss it, is that amount ever discussed? Because that seems like a perfect opportunity for extortion. I mean, for the guy simply to set up the situation where, you know, she doesn't please me, then the father is obligated. So I would have thought that if one can, so to speak, acquire a woman for marriage for such a woman who is pristine, then at this point it would be illogical that amount would be anything other than a token payment. We asked before about what is the father.
Well, let's just take it in the context of the Torah. I mean, a lot of the things we're bringing to this, because we already know the Talmud, I'm not sure what, you know, futah and so on, I don't know what these payments are that we're talking about here. They are probably the payments of a debt. Right? A man enters into this arrangement probably because he has received a certain amount, he has a debt, and he's paying off a debt as a result of it. So the key thing is here that some payment, either the payment of the debt or some other payment, I don't know from the context, is made by the father to the master, and she goes out before the end of the period of time. Right? She'll be sold for 6 years, she goes out before that. Right? Which is just unique because it can't happen with her brother. The man is just in a different position. So let's leave it at that. Now, so let's go back to our Talmud now. There is a Mishnah. Okay? And this Mishnah, in Ketubot, speaks of the girl who is either a Nara or a Katana. Right? She's either in the first 6 months of having from 12 to 12 and a half, or younger than that, where the father, in fact, has certain rights still. Okay? All right, let's see. Ha'av zakai bevito bekidusheha bechesef bishtar ubeviya. A father has rights to his daughter's kiddushin with respect to money, the documents, and bia, and sexual relations. Right? Which is to say, the way that she would get married. But keep in mind here what the Mishnah is saying. In other words, if a man were to marry this woman, she's a young woman, question is, does she get to keep the money? Right? for this class, 12 and a half and below, Michelle says she doesn't keep the money. Her father gets the money. Okay, because as a child, surely it would be easy if we're 12 or below, but for whatever reason, it is also good for the next 6 months. So a child doesn't own property. In most cases, a child doesn't own property, except in case of inheritance. There are a variety of cases where a child may own property, but a child doesn't deal in property. The parent deals in the child's property. Okay? That's what the Torah is saying. So as far as the kiddushin goes, if she is married, we see that there's a possibility that she could be married, since one of the ways of marriage is kesef. She doesn't get to keep the kesef, the father gets to keep the kesef. Similarly for the shtar. Right? If it is a document, he gets to receive the document. Because again, she's not a legal person. Even though she can be married, she's not a legal person as far as acquisition goes. Bi'a, that we have to just translate a little bit, their intercourse, he has the right to, in fact, hand her over to this guy, so that in fact she will have relations with him. And so if normally the father has both the right and the duty to protect the daughter, to make sure that the daughter does not have relations with somebody, here it's the opposite. He's handing her over to the guy by saying, yes, you'll marry my daughter, you have the permission and you have by right, because I am her father. So he has that right apparently at this stage of the game. How does the Mishnah know that this is true? That a purchase, this purchase, is made with money? And secondly, that the money which is transferred here becomes the father's and not the daughter's. How do we know that? Rav Yehuda Amar Rav. Rav Yehuda says in the name of Rav, the Amakra. Here's where he will now quote our text in the Bible. For the scripture says, regarding the Hebrew maidservant who becomes a na'ara, the yatz'ah chinam ein kesef, and she shall go out free for no money. Okay? This girl, as soon as she becomes 12 years old, she's automatically released. That's the way the Talmud understands the Bible. That's not what the Bible said. That's not what we understood the Bible to say. Okay? According to the way the Talmud understands it, when it says that she shall go free, chinam, where was the language here? The im shalosh ele lo yasela v'yatz'ah chinam ein kesef. If he denies these three things to her, she shall go out chinam for nothing without money. Now, when the Talmud reads it, it separates that particular piece of the story from what came immediately before. That had nothing to do with the specific marriage per se. But when the woman becomes of age, when she becomes a na'ara, she is freed for no money at all. That's the law in Ketubot. So it means automatically when she becomes 12, she's out of the relationship. And the father doesn't have to pay anything. Right? That's a radical reading of the text, or the biblical text. I'm not going to tell you. What?
Unless he pays sick.
Unless what?
Unless the master, the owner,
yeah,
has sex with her.
Yeah. Oh, if he has the wife, if she has the wife, correct.
Correct.
So he's got a limit of time,
right,
when he can make that decision. He's got to make a decision by the time she's 12.
Right.
Okay? Because after that, she goes out automatically. She goes out on. Right.
But where does she go? Does she go
back to her father? She goes back to her father's house. Okay? Because she needs support. So while she's with this other guy, the other guy's going to support her.
Mm.
And in fact, the father was relieved of her support. But in this case, now she goes back to the father has to support her. Okay? So, Amar Rav, Yehuda Amar Rav, Damar Krav, Yatz'ah Chinam Ein Kesef. She goes out without a payment for no money. Ein kesef la don zeh. The Talmud glosses this in the following way. It says, no money is given to this master when a na'ara leaves his jurisdiction. Namely, you don't give it to the master. So it's as if the zeh is in italics. It's emphasized. Right? It says, ein kesef la don zeh. V'yatzachinam ein kesef. V'yatzachinam. This one doesn't get any money. Aval yesh kesef la don acher. But there is somebody else who does get the money. Who's that? The father. Right? So in other words, this trumps the cards in favor of the father as opposed to the master. The master can lose her, gets no payment. The father, if there is any kind of a payment, namely, what kind of payment could there be? One kind of payment. There's only one kind of payment. Kiddushin. That she gets married. Right? So Talmud glosses all these things which are obviously not the simple meaning of the text in order to say that if you see the way in which it's building even in this context a certain protection for her, she's going out automatically, right? That guy doesn't get anything, not a good situation. On the other hand, one of the ramifications of the language is that if in fact she's married, the father is the one who gets the kiddushin. Okay? Uman nihu, who is this other master? Ah, the other master is the father. There's only two possibilities here. One is the father, and one is the slave master. Alright, so hence we deduce when an ordinary na'ara, one who is not a maidservant, leaves her father's jurisdiction, namely when she becomes betrothed, money must be received by her father. Right? That's what we said. If she's going to be betrothed, the father gets to keep the money. And in fact, that's generalized. Forget the maidservant situation. From this, we learn a general principle. A general principle of law that a child like this doesn't have the right to a financial transaction. The father has that right. Now, keep in mind when we started this, of course, we looked at Roman law, and we saw that the father was crucial figure in Roman law all the way through. That for a woman to get married, the father had to marry the woman off. The father and the father received the money. Here you see that there is some truth to that, but it stops at the age of 12. So that it's all connected with minority status. The minority status, in fact, is a compromise status. Once a person achieves a majority, then the person is a legal person according to the law. That's where it differs radically from Roman law.
There seems to be a very serious policy issue.
You think so?
Encourage fathers to tell their daughters as young as possible.
Of course. So, I mean, that's what you wonder about when you read this, and in truth, in all honesty, I've never seen any evidence of this in Jewish law. You don't have any of this in the Talmud. The Talmud plays around in order to get you out of that circumstance. So, as you can see, it's working now to sort of build in and to read things not as they in fact read, but to read them more or less along the lines of the way they'd rather read them, okay? Or to use this for another purpose. To learn a different issue of law from this. It becomes almost a springboard to learn issues of law. We know from many countries in this world, this is in fact done on a regular basis. Mm-hmm. This is a way that you deal with poverty. I remember reading stories about India. That there were places where, in fact, fathers didn't want to support their daughters to begin with.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's another mouth to feed, mm-hmm. and the daughter's a sellable quantity, mm-hmm. and you get rid of her. So, you know, when you read that, you wonder about that, and that seems that it would make for very bad public policy as far as we are concerned. All I can say is that I don't see that's the way it actually happens in this system, but it does make it worse.
Is there a minimum age below which?
Three.
Wow.
Three. Yep. Three.
You can designate the child.
You can designate the child.
Correct.
And it could be valid, we can get money for it. In theory. At the earliest age you have a possible marriage with the age of three. It's all connected. Not that it's ever done. I mean, I have no idea, I've never seen any instance of that, although it's a rhetorical issue. For example, in the story about Rebecca and her marriage with Isaac, if you read Rashi there, she was 3 years old.
Mm-hmm.
She was 3 years old at that time, and it has to do with the computations of a variety of biblical verses. But that's what I'm saying. That's the point. Logically, it's ridiculous. Rhetorically, it works, because the rhetoric of the verses is that you can make a computation based on the ages of different people if you read the scriptures in a certain way. Therefore, that figure of 3 years comes to be a rhetorical figure. By rhetorical, I mean it is, you say, when could you do it? From what age? You could do it from three. Does that mean that people did it from three? As far as I can see, the answer is no, because I just never saw any instance in any of the literature where, in fact, it's done. Now, as opposed to the cultures where it's done, where you know about it. Sooner or later, we expect to see something. That having been said, it is rhetorically a part of the way in which you talk about those things. As I say, when you say, how young could a girl be? She could be 3 years old. Why? Because Rivka was 3 years old. Right? It's not saying that she should be 3 years old. But it's a rhetorical thing. Yes.
And part of why, in the case discussed about the Nahara, the question of puberty is not raised.
Well, it's not raised here. It's not raised here. The assumption is that puberty is the key issue, in fact. Puberty is the key issue. Puberty is the issue, very explicitly so. And if there are no signs of puberty, let's just take that as an option. Let's say a girl were 12 and a half and had no signs of puberty. In fact, then she wouldn't be a Nahara. She doesn't have physical signs of puberty. The assumption is that, generally speaking, this is always the case, so that if you have both puberty and the age of 12, most cases fit into that set of facts. Okay?
Yeah, well, you see this statistically in terms of marriage, it's only in recent times that people marry for very different reasons.
Not necessarily. Well, not necessarily, because in that same story I just told you about with Isaac. Right? Remember the story of Isaac. Mm-hmm. In the Torah, the way the Torah reads, and let's read the Torah literally. The Torah says that Isaac is out in the field, mm-hmm. and Rivka sees him, and she's on top of the camel. What happens?
She falls
off the camel. So, I mean, just that kind of language, for instance, is language that I well understand totally from a modern context. Mm-hmm. And then what does it say about Isaac? He takes her into his mother's tent, Vayeha, and he loved her. Now, yeah, that's right. But still he loves her. It doesn't have to say that. There's no reason, because I could well assume that love has nothing to do with it. That we have a whole system of relationships here, let's say, which are based on reproduction. That feelings and relationships are irrelevant. And there are plenty of such cultures around. There are plenty of cultures. There are plenty of where I just came from. I mean, the history of Japanese culture is that kind of history. You have in fact two wives, or three wives, or 10 wives. And you have a wife who you reproduce with. That's your source of your children. And then you have a wife who you love. You know, you have somebody who you love, somebody who you really have feelings for. And in many cultures, and there's no reason to assume that our culture would have any notion of love, but it does. I mean, it's right there, and that's exactly the same story. So that's an interesting culture. Let's go on. Just let's follow the logic here. In a way, it takes so much to get into this material that we can sit, we can stay with this material forever. But all of this is actually moving somewhere else. It's moving somewhere else. We're into a logical argument now. We have seen the odd interpretation of Scripture where it says, V'yatz'achinam ein kesef. Right? She shall go out for no money, ein kesef. That, in fact, is what the Talmud is interested in. Because remember, the Talmud started out looking for some biblical source for the payment of money. So here we have a biblical source about the payment of money, having to do with a young woman, having to do with the change of status, okay? And we learn two things from it. One, that there is money involved, and two, that the money goes to the father. But now the Talmud says, 3b2, to Emer Lidida, you just said to me that the Torah says, that it should go to one party, and that namely it shouldn't go to the master. The master shouldn't get the money. Well, fine. But why should you say it doesn't go to the girl? If you say, logically, you're reading the scriptures to say it can't go to the master, and you're assuming that that the results of that are it must go to the father, that's not logical. All right, let's say it's logical to read the Torah as saying it shall not go to the master. In fact, there are two logical possibilities. One is the father. There's another one. What's the other one? The girl. So that's what the Talmud says. The aim of the Dida, maybe it goes to her. You told me that it doesn't go to the master. You haven't proven to me why it goes to the father. I can understand it should go to her. Okay? Hachi hashta, wonderful rhetoric. Now then, it's a good translation. Now then, aviha mikabel kiddusheha. Clearly, her father accepts the money for her kiddushin yichti, because it is written there in a totally different passage in the book of Deuteronomy. It says the amar aviha nara. And the father of the Na'ara, namely this girl who is 12 and a half to 12, Elazar Kenim, this is the woman gets married, husband comes and complains the next day she wasn't a virgin. Okay? Father's not happy about this either, because this woman, she was supposed to be a virgin. Guy got a certain amount of money for it. And the father got a certain amount of money for it. She turned out not to be. So, Ve'amar Aviha Na'ara Zekenim, the father of this Na'ara, who's being accused of not being a virgin, Et Biti Natati La'isha Zeh, I have given my daughter to this man as a wife. I'm sorry. This is a different context now. This is, I've given my, the father says to the eldest, my daughter I've given to this man as a wife, and he despised her. Right? He despised her. This is going to lead now to a divorce. Right? This is where it's going to go. Okay? So it says, the father says, I have given my daughter, Natati La'ish. So the father does the giving. The father has some power here in the context. Context is one of the Na'ara. And in a way, what we're learning from that is if a woman is older than a Na'ara, she's under her own power. But if she is only a Na'ara, the father has the power. Okay? So that's what the Talmud is learning now from that verse. So it says, Avam Hachi Hashta Avi Amikabel Kiddusheha. He receives her kiddushin. Dichtiv et biti natati la ishazah. I entered into the bargain with this guy. Natati. I've given. In other words, I give, I receive. He's the active party. The EE shot like husband? You think if he's the active party, she's going to take the money? That's what Thomas Rich said. If the Torah says, Natati, I have given that man money, so the father's obvious to the active party. So she should get the money. That's not what you call a forceful argument, but that's where they go. The Emahani Nili Kitana. Well, let us say that this compromised position of the girl pertains only in the case of where she is a ketana, that she's a minor. Because yes, we do understand that minors have compromised rights in the law. So let's assume that she's only a minor. Too late, la yad la kabel kiddushin. She has no yad. That is to say, she has no legal power to engage in transactions.
She's not handy.
Okay. Well, yeah, but it's a technical term here. There's no legal power to engage in a transaction because she's a minor. Okay? Aval nara de itla yad lekabel kiddushin, but a nara, this girl who is 12 to 12 and a half, she does have the power to enter into transactions because the Torah itself said nara. Okay? Tzaktish ihi na shevetish kol kaspa, let the daughter betroth herself and take the money herself. Therefore, there is no evidence then that the father's rights apply even to a nara. Now, where does this lead us? In fact, the Talmud is going to go on with this discussion, seriously, for quite some while. And I'm going to skip that material, because it doesn't really take us anywhere that I think is important for us to go. What the Talmud is trying to do is to find a scriptural source for the payment of money. One of the interesting things is that it has not first offered what was obvious, namely what we read in the beginning of the Talmud. Instead, it tries to work it out of other situations in the Torah, situations that are interpreted far beyond their literal meaning, and to find from that some scriptural source. You probably have a sense already about how successful that is going to be. Not very successful. Not very successful, because you see what they're trying to do. They're trying to find things, and it's obvious that this is not an obvious thing. Not an obvious thing.
It looks like they're faced with the society they're seeing,
yeah,
and what the practices are, and they're trying to develop the scriptural or the process by which they got to where they are. They know where they are.
Mm-hmm.
They then have the choice. They can,
that's probably right. That's correct.
by saying it's wrong and here's the evidence, or they can say it's right, and obviously it's right here in the Bible.
Mm-hmm.
I just didn't know how to interpret it.
Correct. So I think that that's correct. You do have those choices, and you see that they will frequently try to justify practice on the basis of some scriptural source, no matter how far or distant that source is from in fact where they want to take it. Right? Not that this is that far. These are somewhat relevant circumstances. You are talking about women, you are talking about changes of status, you are talking about fathers, you are talking about money. So there are a variety of things here that in a sense are relevant, even though I don't find it particularly compelling. I think it is relevant. It is also possible, I don't think that we necessarily have to assume that practice exists entirely without law, and then law comes and develops and simply provides justification for it. I think that probably in areas such as marriage, I would be surprised if there isn't an ongoing tradition. Because marriage in any society is subject to custom and law. I don't think there's a society on the earth that doesn't have that. So I would just extrapolate from such a thought that probably there is an ongoing history of this, and that ongoing history could use these scriptural verses, might have used them, could have used them homiletically, could have used them loosely, could have used them not so loosely. There's no way of knowing that. But I think all these things are within the realm of possibility.
When you get to the point of having to write it down and codify it, then you've got to find how you got from the Bible to where you are,
mm-hmm.
in a way that's going to be compelling and logical, mm-hmm. in that style.
I would go, I'd take that even a step further. I think that as you see the progress of this argument, the argument has proceeded by asking a logical question. Where in the Bible do we learn what we found in the Mishnah? Okay? And it takes the first thing in the Mishnah, Kesef, and it proceeds. Of course, it's not finished with that. Even in terms of what we will skip, it's going to move in another direction shortly. In a direction that's more satisfying ultimately to the argument, because this one is just going, it's too loose in a way, it's not compelling enough. So there will be another type of argument that will come, and an argument that we're familiar with, in fact. So that's going to be repeated now. The same way of thinking will be repeated for all three of the methods of Kiddushin. So that I think that what we are witnessing here is a well-formulated discussion which appears here in the Talmud, each part of which is more or less identical to the other part, which is part of either the oral law as it was taught, probably that's what we're reading, or as it gets set down in a literary form, an effort is made to in fact create a symmetry of development. Because that's what you do when you write. When you write things, you know, when you have three things, you want to prove them the same way three times. And that's just a very neat way of proving your case. I can't say it's absolutely the result of writing, because you can do that, a lawyer will do the same thing in an oral argument. Okay? But it is a contained piece, each piece of which is developed in the same way. Okay? Let's go further. Did we get to the end there? Yeah. Now skip to 4B1. What we have skipped involves, among other things, the next step in the argument, which is a kal vachomer argument. That is to say, there are certain things which we could learn which are true in one type of change of status that might or might not be true in another type of change of status. We've seen that the first thing we saw was not a kal vachomer argument. The next one goes something like this. The Yevama, who we discussed at the end of last week's session. This is the woman whose husband died. There are no children. The husband's brother is required to marry her. Okay? Now, when the Torah discusses that, the Torah speaks of it in terms of him having relations with her. So the Torah actually says the nature of yibum, instead of relations. Okay? So if you want to say, well, in the case of Yibum, which is a sort of an odd form of marriage, you have relations, and you have no money passing hands. In a less odd form of marriage, you wouldn't want to have it the same as Yibum, would you? That's the way this argument goes in what we're skipping. Not, again, a very compelling argument, but that's the way the argument progresses. Now we come to 4B1, left side of the page, about halfway down. Earlier, Rabbi Yehuda had deduced from the verse, V'yatzah chinam ein kesef. That's where we left off. It said, V'yatzah chinam, and she shall go out for free, ein kesef. No money. That a woman may be betrothed with money. Right? That was the putative idea we were trying to derive from that verse. one of the two ideas. We got two ideas. Well, that was one of them. All right. Now, the Gemara brings a different breakdown. And says the following. Vitana maitela meacha. Vitana, in fact, deduces kesa from another source. What source? Ki yikach ish isha ubiyama. If a man were to take a woman as a wife, ubiyala, and have relations with her, vaya im lo timsachen beinav ki matzava zavatava, and he doesn't like her, because he finds something repellent about her, right? And then the Torah goes on to give us the laws of the get. Techatan la sefer kritut. He may write for her a bill of divorcement. And it's from that verse that all of our laws of giving come. Okay? Translated this for you. And then the Gemara goes on. The Brita goes on. Ein kicha ela bekesef. When it says ki kach isha, when a man takes a woman, it refers, taking doesn't mean taking per se. That is terminology used for a financial transaction. Ein kicha ela kesef. V'chein hu omer natati kesef hazeh kach imeni. Asadeh. I have given you the money for the field, take it from me. What's that about? Abraham and Ephraim the Hittite. Right? This is what we saw earlier on in the Gemara. So originally, probably, it existed as a part of this long sugya that we're meeting it now. Then when the Gemara was edited, that particular part, which is the most logical of the arguments, was taken because it was useful at the very beginning of the discussion in order to put the things in a reasonable context so that we know what we're talking about. Because the issue of the nature, was it a transaction, or all those kinds of other things we talked about? Here is probably where it starts. Next page. Amar Rav Ashi, Mishum de'ikala meka memar me'ikara de dina pircha. See, Marat, just before, tried to prove what I said to you in my summation of the next effort to prove a source by Kal Vachomer. Right? If the Yibum situation involves only sex, isn't it likely that a situation which is more normal will involve a more normal transaction, more or less like that? Okay? So it leaves it there, and then it comes in and brings a scriptural source. Now, for me as the reader, there's a good reason why it came and bring a scriptural source. Because the other source wasn't very convincing. Right? It was a kind of logical argument, but it doesn't have really that kind of compelling logic. Yeah, you can force it. But it's much better if you can find a scriptural source. So the Gemara says, Mishum the Ika Lemeim and the Ika the Dina Pircha. Why the Gemara wants to know, weren't you satisfied with my Kal Vachomer argument? Why weren't you satisfied with that? Because there was a problem with it. Pircha, there was a weakness in the Kal Vachomer. From where have you deduced that money should go to effect kiddushin? Me amaha ivriya. We've started out by learning this whole thing from the Hebrew maidservant. That's where we got started out. We learned from the Hebrew maidservant. Mala amaha ivriya shaken yotza bekesef. As in fact, what comparison can be made to the Hebrew maidservant who goes out with money? Right? That was the whole force of this thing. How does she get out of her servitude? You pay. You pay. So the Gemara says, how could you have brought that thing in the first place? You tried to learn about kesef from the Hebrew maidservant. But she is released from her situation by the payment of money.
You're going the other direction.
Okay? We're going in the other direction. Right? We're going in the other direction. And a married woman, how is she released from her relationship? Let's say a woman is married. We learned in the Mishnah that she can get out of that. How does she get out of it? A get through the death of her husband. All right? So in fact, she can get out of it, but with a get. The Hebrew maidservant, how does she get out of it? By paying kesef. Right? She's paying kesef. So how can you learn from one situation about the other situation? How can you do that? Right? Talmud Lomar, therefore we need the scriptural verb, ki kach ish isha. When a man takes a woman, namely the verse that we read in the very beginning of the Talmud when we started the year. Okay. So all of this going around, we tried to find it from the Hebrew maidservant, then we tried to go to a Kal Vachomer, now we're back to the Hebrew maidservant. We attacked that not only because it seemed flimsy when we were in it, but there was a logical problem with the whole thing, because it's taking her out with money and not putting her in with money, number one, and secondly, a woman who is married cannot be taken out for money, she has to be taken out with a get, which is a written document. So in fact, there is no comparison between these two situations. You need a scriptural source. You found a scriptural source in the document. Okay? That's the whole thing.
We could have started.
We never could have started. We could have ended up here. Because, you know, people like to find lots of different sources, and people think that religion also should be argued on the basis of logic. Well, maybe that's true. Logic is not irrelevant to religion. So you see logic used in the application of a lot of abstruse possibilities used. But when it comes down to it, if you can find some good scriptural sources, they really do better than anything else. And that's where we finally concluded, to go back to where we started, about Abraham and Ephron the Hittite, and Ki Kach Ish Isha, when a man takes a woman for a wife. Question? So we continue next week. And next week you know what we're going to do. The next one we started with Keseh. We're now going to go to Shtar. Same argument now to see the next of the methods of Kiddushin. It's not